Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about sodalites and zeolites. They're interesting materials. I find them interesting, at least. Sodalites are sort of like the precursors of zeolites, and zeolites means dancing rock. I think someone did an experiment and saw it danced on some water and stuff like that. Now, what are zeolites? So, well, zeolites can be the stuff. It's a molecular sieve, so it's a material which is mostly whole, a bit like honeycomb. You eat honeycomb, but much more ordered than it. It's like a naturally occurring sieve, but a very tiny sieve, which is enough to let nitrogen through, but not oxygen. So it's an amazing material. It's a sieve, and it's got me absolutely fascinated. And I've sort of looked at different materials, but this material really jumps out at you. So this is a rock where about 50% of it is void. You think it is heavy. It's not as light as pumice, which is basically aerated glass, which gets shot out of a volcano. And if you walk around the beaches of Australia, depending on certain days and certain mists, you can pick up bits of coal, which is just floated. Coal actually floats, which is pretty amazing. But also pumice floats. Pumice is basically glass, which has got so much high-pressure gas in it that when it bursts out of a volcano, it's a frothy sort of glass, air-filled glass. And, there's lots of glass gets thrown out of volcanoes, for instance. So glass is any disordered substance. But this is anything but disordered. And in this episode, we're just going to go into zeolites, the fascinating things, and eventually see how they can make lots of very interesting things. Practical things for their purposes. They've been picked up by the health food industry. You eat zeolites because it absorbs bad smells. I don't know whether it's an anti-fart thing. Activated charcoal. Activated charcoal is another thing. I'll probably do an episode on that. So zeolites and sodalites, that all goes together. And I'll give you a general story of it. Where I find it most fascinating, it's the porous materials, and you can actually control the porosity of the zeolite that you add. And so you can start from high porosity or sort of fairly dense zeolite and actually thin it out, and you can actually sort of just ease the surface off into air and create a graded refractive index. So there is some zeolites which transmit light, and so you can actually build a dense zeolite and actually go out to a dense zeolite molecular sieve. And I'll give you a structural view of it very, very soon. You'll be able to see how it goes, and I'll give you a few clues to looking at. So it's a basic formula of T, O4. T is not anything. T could be a combination of silicon and aluminium. And in general, look, a lot of the rocks on Earth are sandstone, which is silicon dioxide. And as you add more and more metal to it, you tend to get something called shales, micas, and stuff like that. What happens is that the metal sort of mixes in with the glass and forms metal layers within the glass. It's sort of like a metamaterial on the sand. So you get a silicon dioxide layer and then a metal layer off the top of it, and these form shear layers. So if you get shale or anything which is heated up and has a lot of metal in it, you'll get a combination between sandstone. So it's, you get, there's a sort of continuum from sandstone to shale, and the more metal you add to quartz, it'll basically change and go through other minerals which have cleavage planes, and they flake off, and eventually, or slate. Slate is an example. There's heaps of metal in slate, and that's got just big cleavage planes, so you can actually cleave off slabs of this light rock and make a slate roof. But zeolite really stands out as something different. And there's naturally occurring ore bodies of zeolite, but in fairly funny countries, I think, or not so much in Australia. It's an igneous rock. You heat it up, and you get sand as SO2, and a bit of aluminium oxide in there. In general, another abundant element, aluminium oxide, and the two go together to make a series of materials called a molecular sieve. So a molecular sieve is great because you can actually sieve different gas molecules through it. You can actually put different gas molecules through it. What really amazes me is that argon doesn't go through it. I think helium whoops through it, and nitrogen goes through it, but oxygen does not as well. So it is actually a molecular sieve, and we use it to actually squirrel away nitrogen in and leave oxygen out of it, and then filter off the oxygen and argon, and that way we can actually sort of separate gas with a sieve. It is a sieve for gas. It's a molecular sieve, and then there's heaps of other applications of it. I know it's in the health food industry. It's sort of, what isn't in the health food industry? My goodness, that's a Chinese. Moxibustion. I'll tell you a bit about that on another talk. But it's also used in animals. You mix in with the feedstock. This is zeolite mixed in with the feedstock, and it changes their nitrogen absorption. It takes the smell out of, if you've got a urinary bathroom, some zeolite's ideal because it reacts with the urea, fixes the nitrogen, it sort of destroys the ammonia smell. So zeolite, and there's lots of, mixes you have with it. It's got a lot of applications with it, and the stuff that I like is the fact that we've now learnt how to grow zeolite layers, transparent zeolite layers, and actually just drift the refractive index off. And if you drift, you have a uniformly varying refractive index, and the actual refractive index doesn't, vary in a rigid way, you can actually make a very low reflective, high strength, low refractive, low reflective surface. Now, that's not commercially a viable thing to do. I'm sure there's compromises with it, so you can't buy it. I might be wrong. Whether you have zeolite coated camera lenses and things like that, I'd be very interested in using it in some optoelectronics further down the track. So hopefully I've got your interest up in what zeolite is. And you can hear me possibly walking. I'm just going on a cardiac walk, just getting ready as I'm going along here. And what I'm doing is, before I'll get you the structure of zeolite really soon, what I'm doing is going back, restructuring my brain, and sort of discovering, I can't remember certain things, but then other things I do, I'm sort of remembering things in a sort of a different order, coming back in a different way. So as I've said before, there's different grades of zeolite, starting to you could actually say that non-porous zeolite is is sodalite, and sodalite is a bluey semi-precious gem. You polish it up. I'm actually rather fascinated with it. It's sort of probably, I don't know, I've got certain things that, like, I like star sapphire. Star sapphires, I like, I love opals. But I think I'm going to also love sodalite. So I've actually not seen any of these. I'm sure they're out there. Sort of a milky, very complex, milky blue, intense blue gem, a semi-precious gem I'd like to know about. And that's your basic zeolite. It's on the way to making molecular sieve. And it's a molecular sieve with holes so small that no molecules can get through it. So it's like a solid crystal. So a solid crystal is full on solid. Zeolite's got big gaps in it. And so we'll start off with sodalite. Still the formula TO4. Something more than that. And it's really intensely interesting to look at it. So for any of these, for anything, if you want to have a good look at the three-dimensional molecule makeup of it, just type the name of something and then JMOL in your browser and you'll be able to have a look at it. So sodalite, so we're going into discussing what the formula of zeolite is. So zeolite is, if you go fast, if you start at the origin of what we're talking about as pure sand or pure quartz, which is silicon dioxide, we're replacing the silicons with metals. And if we're not careful when we do it, and it won't form holes, it'll form a shale down the path. Sails and slates and things like that. It'll form planes like that. But if you do it really carefully, something really weird happens. Now, the sodalite, I've forgotten what the formula, exact mix of metals in it, silicon dioxide and some metals replaced into it. Sodalite, if you would like, is some well-structured combination of silicon and I suppose aluminium. I just don't think, I think there may be, oh, I don't think there's any iron in there. But that's formed, and if you imagine a sports room with hundreds of soccer balls all stacked one on top of each other, you know, a square, you've got a square box, and it can just fit neatly, say, 5x5 soccer balls at the bottom of it, and then you stack up another 5x5, which is another 25, and stack it up to it's 5 high, you'll get this is something which looks very much like sodalite. So it's sort of like a meta structure. There's a crystalline which has a meta structure in it, and you can see these little gaps in it. And when you really space fill it, the gaps are really not that big. Can't see it, but there are definitely gaps in it, but they're not significant gaps that molecule, or you can cage a few, I suppose you can cage, truly I've pumped high pressure hydrogen into glass, to process optical fibres, I suppose you can press a few glass gas molecules in there, but in general there's nothing very special about it. So I just want you to keep sodalite is sort of like the super dense zeolite, but it's not a sieve, and it's got the basic units of a silicon and a cluster of aluminium atoms and oxygens around it in a little ball to make your soccer ball, and then you stack those soccer balls up and you create the interstitial sites, not in between atoms, but between clusters of atoms, and you get sodalite. Very interesting molecule. Have a good look at it. Now we go up to zeolite. Now, what I'm going to do is say, you get a slightly larger box, but you can have a ring. Don't know what I could call for a ring. You know those quoits there. Can you imagine some small, about 3 quoits made in a little cylinder, and you stack it. So you stack 25 by 25, but between each of those, you have a quoit, sort of three quoits. And so in the first layer, you put the first strip of five, you put, four quoit cylinders in there. So it spreads it out, and so just imagine you've got a slightly larger box and you're still putting in, and you put another the quoits that's going horizontally across, and you build up the next group of five, and you put five quoits and bring in the soccer ball, such that between every soccer ball, as you're putting down there, is a little cylinder. And this is the key to understanding zeolites. And you're beginning to make a zeolite, and you build this up. So between every, where the soccer balls were touching each other in a close cubic thing, that is the soccer balls are a cube going upwards. They're actually spaced a little bit. The holes are spaced a little bit by a cylinder. And essentially, when you really look at it, when you develop the looking of this, I think you can get pure silicon ones, or some of the ones I've seen. But you can actually structure it like this, such that you get a ball shape. I'm not telling you in terms of tetrahedrons and shapes like that, and a link one, which is slightly narrower. And you can imagine here, that's beginning to get some slightly larger holes for it. And that is now molecular sieves. Molecules, atoms, not long, complicated, yucky atoms, but simple, small atoms can start to pass through your material. You have created a solid material which can let gas through it. Now, as you go up, you can make more and more complicated stuff, and that's just the basic thing. So if you look at a zeolite structure, sodalite is just soccer balls stacked to each other. Zeolite starts with the balls spaced by space links between each of the ball. So each ball touches six other balls, and so it's got these six other spaces in it. And the spaces typically is a metal oxide, and the center soccer balls is silicon oxide. So as you tweak it up, and you make this thing. And indeed, look, if you get an electron microscope to it and see it expanded up, or a scanning tunnel microscope, you can see this amazing structure. And what a fantastic structure. What, surely we can use that for a memory or something to do it. Add magnetic property. Oh, look, it's just expanding. And as you go, you can create a slightly more complicated straight. We get a ring of smaller holes, and it gets confused and makes a fairly big hole between the rings. Look at the other zeolite structures out there. There's not more than 100, there's about 40 allowed zeolite structures. I'm sure someone's got on a supercomputer and just given it free parameters and the range to see if it can come up with zeolite structures. And so these structures are solid, like solid metal. So everyone thinks of solid state in a certain way. It's almost like looking at the Fermi surfaces in momentum space, where they've got big gaps in between it, and it repeats indefinitely in momentum space, which is interesting, but it's like in real space. So zeolites, it's an amazing structure. And what I want to do in this podcast, at least, is give you the mental machinery of what it's used for. So I think I read it's used in chicken sheds. So this is really cheap throwaway material. Well, a lot of people, when it's mined naturally, rather than clay, it's this thing which removes a lot of the smell from chicken sheds and changes the quality of feed. It's got digestive properties and stuff like that. And you know, whether it's a molecular sieve that they have in the health food place, you can eat it as a health food. I think getting you to eat anything, whether it reacts in such a way that it, I suppose, affects the actual macromolecules. I can't see it's taking out big toxic molecules of viruses or anything like that. But I can't imagine it taking out some gases and some knocking out some gases which are produced, which you could imagine a bad virus or something, a bacteria, to get going. Is it likes to produce a bad gas, and that bad gas causes the body to secrete stuff. You can imagine that could sort of nail an attack plan of a bacteria or something like that. But you look at it, and what I've given you is an idea of the structure of it, an idea of some of the use of it. So the structure is this socket, this ball and spacer idea. And so the ball and spacer gives you the first order zeolite. So the spacers mean that the space between the holes gets sort of significantly grows larger. And then I would call it a second order. I think they actually do it. A second order one where the spacing is stuck, that it gets a bit confused and actually makes a fairly large uniform hole between them. Now, we're going to finish off on reading some of these articles that I've read about where they can control the porosity of the zeolite. And so that means that the refractive index tails off to one. So you've got a layer and you can just uniformly tail off the refractive index. And this is an incredibly powerful optical tool that you can have. So normally you have reflection is where there's a discontinuity in refractive index, and here you can just smooth and address that discontinuity. So I'm really interested in terms of laser resonators, all these things that you could do with this, you know, how it selects you know, where a position is, you know, how many wavelengths things are in, and the ability to do it. I'm also interested in a zeolite glass, if you can make a zeolite glass for where you can actually pump gas through it. So I'll get back to you in a short while on that. So that's zeolites, the structure of it, and I hope it's been instructive. Bye for now. 3D printing. Some unusual things in 3D printing. So the general idea of 3D printing is the most common that you see, you can buy in the supermarkets nowadays for a few hundred dollars, is this glue gun, which is positioned in an XYZ space, and you have a feed of tubing into the 3D glue gun, and the glue gun just walks around and slowly builds up a goop layer. So pretty much like you did with plasticine when you were a kid. You're making a little house and you start off with the foundations and you build it up in 3D to actually build a little plasticine house. And it's very impressive to see it. If not, you see a really impressive viewpoint and a lot of motion and action. It builds it by one wire at a time. There is my wife's blind, and I bought a 3D pen. I thought, oh, this will be great. And essentially, you can, rather than get a robot to do it, you can actually do it yourself and work out how to make things in three dimensions and be able to glow things in three dimensions. The advantage with this is that you can, I suppose, you can come in with different materials through your thing, introduce different materials and different colours. I'm pretty sure that they've done that. And I've had a few models built in 3D glue, 3D machining. I've had a few prototype parts and optoelectronics, and when I wanted to discuss the idea of a camera, this Ladybird 3D camera, for many years ago, I had one printed up rather than buy one, just so I could show the the politician involved, and I was able to paint it afterwards. And it's quite an interesting model. Now, of course, we want to in any of these things, the general idea is that I'm giving you an overview of 3D printing. I can remember in 1990, I was in Canada, and there was a big excitement that someone had the patent for 3D printing. I first heard about the patent for Bragg ratings and also the patent for 3D printing, and essentially it was a heat source in a particular bath, and it would be printed upwards as this heat source went around. It's miraculous things. And of course, what is it, 30 years later, or 30 years later, every man and his dog's got a 3D printer. Of course, you've got the high volume throughput and stuff like that. And of course, this general thing where I'm talking to an audience there, what's the value of listening to me if I don't actually go a bit, take you a few steps forward? Now, of course, there's several ways you can go with it. Sophistication, direct improvement. There's different robotic manipulations with, oh, I've forgotten what the different Scara. I've forgotten the robotics terms. That there's different types of robots that you can have with robots with high speed, moving in the Z direction. Three pillars in the Z direction pulls up a platform at high speed and positions it around the place with a pantograph down there. Or you can have the traditional X, Y, Z elements. Moving on with the X, Y, Z, you can have multiple things. Speed and heat is still a problem to get through it. So where can this go? Well, it's gone. I think that I've seen a Russian firm. Look, I'm really just going off the top of my head. A Russian firm, which is, I think even Chinese firm, which rather than glue, has got quick-setting concrete, which just pours out the end of the tube, which they just slosh around, and then I think they show at very high speed this person who's lives in a little circular house with the doors at an angle and structure, and it's just built up like that. And I think it's got hollows and cavities in it, and it's obviously something with the reach of the robot. And of course, you have something that builds the house up with the robot on the inside. I don't know how they managed that. They painted it up, and I can remember possibly YouTube this smiling people going into this lovely little house, which has been built at very high speed. Now, having seen the rate at which they put up houses now in Australia, like within just incredibly fast time, just laughably fast, a week or so, it's a full house from coming round. I don't think we're going to see. We may see 3D printed houses, but I just think practically it's not there. But there's also to say there may be some other idea of putting out material. And there's just so many design compromises you can do in something which is, I don't know, if you're building something which is going to last 50 years and you save a week or 2 weeks on the actual building of it, it's almost inconsequential, and the actual cost of moving your robot around the place and setting it up and setting the power into your robot and getting everything organized, I don't know where that's going to be. So this is a 3D printer made big, so you're printing big stuff. That's the ability nowadays to you can print something out up in wax or plastic and then put it in very fine sand, and then heat it up and then flow metal into it. There's a way that you can make these complicated specialist chambers for lasers and optoelectronics making it that way. And so you've got 3D printing. And one of my best friends, or I think one of the first employees of one of my companies, has just made it big in Australia, 3D printing. It's for rapid prototyping and use. So that's 3D printing, and you've got conventional technologies. Now, I want to talk about another technology, which is you have your polymer, which sets. So you've got something which has to go from a coil to a liquid and then set. And so you can do that with heat. It goes like a hot melt glue gun, and you can do it here. Or you can have a liquid which is set with a refined UV lamp. And what they do is they have a glass tray and a puddle of this epoxy. And I do know a bit of epoxy chemistry. And or they have it sitting on a glass plate, and they have underneath it a UV projector, which projects each layer as it's going up. And they also have this on a special glass, which allows oxygen in. So you have it sitting on basically a glass table, but the glass table is got oxygen. So you can imagine a closed chamber underneath the glass table, and that is producing oxygen pressed into it, high pressure oxygen, and it makes its way, it bleeds out of the glass. Now, one of the things is that the excess of oxygen limits the actual creation of it, so it limits the actual building of it, or the actual bonding. So oxygen inhibits, because if it's an epoxy, it's an oxygen bond, so additional oxygen stops the UV light from interacting, or so it stops the plastic when it starts to solid sticking to your glass plate. So what you can do is that you can have a seed stick and actually pull out of bath, a very shallow bath, a very complicated reentrant object, pulling up from it, same principle of 3D printing, but you can actually just draw object after object, complex object after object, out of a bath. This shallow tray, it may only be 3 millimeters thick. The stuff grows in, it's been cured from underneath the interface, and it lifts out. And so this surely should be a high value thing. So there's different parameters, the amount of UV light, the temperature, and the amount of oxygen. So you just need barely enough oxygen such it doesn't cure onto the glass, so you don't, so when you actually fire the UV into it, it doesn't cure onto it. And and then you can change the components such it can be soft and pliable. And of course with this with the individual point, you can actually, I can imagine that you can have different sort of a heat chamber, and you have different colours and different materials being put into this heat chamber. This is on your pen idea, controlling a 3D pen. But this other layer, things sees that you can actually just build it at so many millimetres an hour for the curing rate of it. So I find that interesting, and I can sort of think of thousands of ways of doing it. I suppose that's the technology as it is. I sort of can imagine things where you just have a shape. This is my ultimate idea. The problem is if you've got to move a large amount of material in to make your shape, and the shape has to be sufficiently complex that it's commercially better than to actually get a robot to construct it out of extruded components. But I sort of have an idea of... I love the idea of being able to just lift it out of a bath so it not to exist, and then the complicated shape to be computer-generated and lifted three-dimensionally out of a bath. It's got a real spiritual creativity to it, but you can imagine certain limitations to it. I've got another idea, which I sort of would like, is to actually make... also, obviously for this, I'm sure there's 3D printed food that have to be, where you actually put in chocolate or something like that, different chocolates, and 3D print a chocolate person or a chocolate creation. It seems so obvious that you could actually, or you could liquefy chocolate, obviously, and something which is some sort of liquid polymer, and actually put it there. And I was involved in consulting for a gingerbread man. This was so poorly designed when I came in. This gingerbread man factory just up the road from here had a government grant for the university to come in, and they just had the dumbest robot I had ever seen doing it. They just made everything bespoke rather than just get a cheap ABB industrial robot which has got all the degrees of freedom and could do everything for a fraction of the price they did. They made everything bespoke, and obviously he had so many failure points all over. It was a disaster. But they had this one which had a robot icing a gingerbread man factory up here has a robot icing the little gingerbread figures that people eat. And of course that's the sort of thing that if you were, I'm sure people would import it from China and stuff like that, but obviously fresh gingerbread made locally is one thing. And so I think they have a robotic icing of cakes, and basically piping icing is a form for 3D printing. So I'd like to see that. But what I really would be interested in seeing is where you could have something which is a multiple phase thing, where you could use a material and use UV light to charges to lay charge, electric charge, on your creation. Your creations out of plastic or clay. So I think you'll also do it with clay nanoparticles and stuff like that. And so your laser beam illuminates your object, and then it's charged, and then you electrostatically just release dust into it, and that sticks. And so I could imagine that being a very slow process, but you'd be able to get all different sorts of materials built in composite layers and built something quite quickly and I don't know whether it would be quick, but of course the idea of actually just getting a bath and at a certain rate pulling this up, and you could well imagine it's just tweaking the reaction rate, the amount of oxygen in it involved. Now, yeah, it's a very, very fascinating thing. There's just so many parameters. You'd love to play around with it in this surface. Yeah, it's just something. As I talk, all these ideas are floating in my head. Especially if you can get a titanium dioxide layer on the glass, your glass table. That would be a very interesting structure. So I hope this has been worthwhile for you. This is just a rambling thinking about three-dimensional using 3D printers and, of course, looking at porous glasses, porosity of glass, and things which solids which lets gas through it. There's an industrial application. So I hope listening to it, you're inspired to get onto the internet and look at the latest three-dimensional printing and where that's going as a technology. It's a sort of a beautiful blob history. It's sort of like something that's evolving into different niches as people try different ways. And it's a very interesting, complex thing. Thanks. Thank you for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.